Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter the offer code PEL at checkout to get 10% off.
Hey, this is Wes Alwyn here. For PEL fans who live in the Boston area, I'm giving a talk on philosophy, psychoanalysis, and the film Ex Machina on December 1st. For more information, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/exmachina, or to get a ticket, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/tickets.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Among the many questions we'll address in episode 126 is something like, if in some possible world all the cats were actually demons, would it be really that instead of all the cats actually being demons, there were no cats, just demons that look like what in our world are cats? And we read Saul Kripke's Naming a Necessity, which is a 1980 publication of some lectures given in 1970. You can join the discussion, get the text, lots of more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, necessarily in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn, rigidly designated in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, referring in Middleton, Wisconsin.
And this is, man, Wes stole mine. This is Matt Tykman, standing, referring to the same object at all possible worlds in Chicago.
Yeah, I took the low-hanging fruit.
Me too.
Thought Mark would probably take, but...
Oh, I thought you were just going to say rigid in...
Well, yeah. Do you have to spell it out, Mark? Is that the... I guess that's a definite description of the joke I just...
So, as my little question indicated, it's a little hard to describe what this reading is about, because it's kind of in the middle of the history of an ongoing dispute, so people can listen back to our Frege episode to kind of get the background of where he's coming from about proper names. So it's naming in necessity. So it's a theory of proper names. Why do they refer to the stuff that they refer to? And then his answer to that is going to have something to do with metaphysical necessity.
So there's this question of how names refer to individual entities in the world. And maybe we should start out by trying to say, why is that even a concern? Is it just because I want to understand a mechanism of how the name Mark in this context actually doesn't somehow have a little line going out to Dylan? Or so maybe Matt has a good way of putting this. But what this concern about references, why does it require an explanation?
Yeah, so I guess there are kind of two questions sort of in the background here. One, which is maybe a little bit more the question that I'm interested in, which is just is like, what does a name mean? That's pretty not clear. Like, what does Matt mean? Like, if you had to translate Matt into something, the question's a little weird, isn't it? It's not like if you had to translate to the left of into something, you could sort of explain, well, it's like the opposite direction of to the right of. But like, how would you explain what Matt means? And then people are always drawn to, well, it's just, you know, it's like this guy over here. It's just directly pointing at this guy. Right off the bat, I think the question of what a name is different from the question of what an adjective is or what a verb is or what a preposition is, what other kinds of words are. That's one question I think that's sort of interesting here. And then one of the things he's concerned to argue is that, you know, a name isn't a shorthand for a description. So whatever we do want to say about what a name means, that's going to be complicated. But one thing we can at least say is that it's not just an abbreviation of the guy who lives in Chicago and is on the Partially Examined Life podcast, blah, 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 blah.
So there's meaning and there's reference, and those two things are related, perhaps, but
Certainly
not necessarily the same thing. I think we should describe what this theory of definite descriptions is and what motivates it before you really launch, because I don't think we're going to be able to make sense of this unless we do that.
This other question, which you sort of opened with, which is the one I think that's a little harder to motivate, actually. What is it for a name to refer, or what fact of the matter determines what a name stands for? That one is a little bit more recherché or kind of esoteric. Where does that question come from?
What motivates this? Because I think for an average listener, they're going to be like, well, what do you mean? What's the problem of reference? You know, I'm using the word Mark and that refers to Mark. What's the problem? So
yeah,
that's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah.
To me, it becomes a little more clear when you get in these middle grounds. Like you want to say, well, that's a tree. And somebody says, well, no, it's a bush. And you say, well, what makes it a bush and what makes it a tree? I think pretty quickly it's easy to see how you would go down an idea of a descriptive notion of what every noun means. And I was going to ask Matt if when he was saying about names and he picked Matt, did he also mean to include all nouns?
So we're going to get to natural kinds in this and then mass terms. But initially, we really are thinking about proper names, right?
we have to give some clue of what metaphysical fruit this is ultimately supposed to yield, or else people will just simply turn this off, because so far we got a theory of proper names. Dylan just referred to getting to general categories.
Let's give the theory of definite descriptions and what problems it's supposed to solve. I don't see how we can say what he's saying without saying definite descriptions.
You can't even hint at what the fruit will be?
What is the hint, if you have a concise...
So hint at what the fruit will be. I mean, the pulling apart of a priori and the necessary is a very new idea.
So it was everybody just turned it off right now. They just turned it off.
Give some jargon. The fruit is supposed to be that it says something about the mind-body problem, and it says something about scientific identity. So we discover that water is equal to H2O. That's something that we didn't know from the beginning of time. So it seems like that can't be an a priori truth. It's not something you could just figure out using pure reason. Science had to figure it out. So traditionally, that was the kind of thing that it kind of went in the category of, well, a priori means those are the truths, like mathematical truths or maybe truths about God or whatever, depending on what philosopher you're talking to. Those are the ones that are going to be true in all circumstances, true in all possible worlds.
And necessary. And that's what you mean by necessary.
Necessary. Metaphysically
and
necessary.
A priori and necessary are the same thing for this idea. And by the way, when we're using possible worlds, it's not like we have a multiverse theory of the universe and we're saying all these possibilities really exist in some extent. We talk about possibility all the time, and we call this counterfactuals. In some cases, they're counterfactuals. So what if I hadn't gone to the store this morning and instead had gone to the gym or something like that? That's a particular state of affairs or a circumstance that I'm thinking about with regard to possibility. When I talk about a possible world, I'm thinking about all the states of affairs of which the world consists. So I take all the different things together. So I'm supposing that I went to the store in this alternate possibility and perhaps everything else the same or other things are also different.
Thinking about this is supposed to give you an idea of if there are some things that would be ruled out of any possibility, then you've stumbled on something that's metaphysically necessary. That's a metaphysical fact. If you want to say, I could have gone to the store today, I could have not gone to the store today, could 2 + 2 have equaled 5? It seems like not. It seems like there's no possibility in which something could have happened to make that possible. So the question that Kripke is concerned with, one of them, is, could scientists have discovered that water was, in fact, not H2O, that it was something else? Could there be a possible world in which, once you put it that way, it gets more complicated, even though it's not supposed to be, because you can imagine a possible world where scientists are evaluating this thing that they think is water,
right?
But they actually find out that it's has something other compound than H2O. And so some philosophers would say that's a situation in which, yeah, water turned out in that situation not to be H2O. Kripke's going to have to say that, well, actually, in that world, it wasn't water at all. And so that we'll have to get to why that's the case.
It'll all make a lot more sense once we...
But I think those examples as the kinds of... I mean, Mark, you called them fruits, but they are the kinds of questions that are really on the long lens for Kripke. At the end of the book, a lot of them have to do with understanding the way scientific discovery works and whether or not the discoveries themselves make conclusions that are contingent, that are just one set of conclusions among any other set of conclusions. So, for instance, it was in the past few hundred years that it's claimed, well, what is light? Light is electromagnetic radiation. Kripke wants to say that it's necessarily so that light is electromagnetic radiation. It's not a contingent fact. It's not something that it could have been any other way.
Or rather, if it's true at all, then it's necessarily true.
Exactly.
You might not even be sure
ever
that it's actually true.
That's a very good qualification that we'll have to talk more about, but that's exactly right.
I see these things as actually side arguments. I see the main fruit as a new theory of reference, which we now call the causal theory of reference, but which I think we should wait to describe. So I think all those other things is really... But I didn't see it was the main motivation for this.
Is that the new tree, Wes, or is it the fruit? Because I think that what Mark was describing was the fruit, and what you're talking about is the tree that yields the fruit.
Are you being serious?
I wasn't at first, but now I am. At first, I was just making a joke, but now
we're
I think
all the best
actually that's a pretty good analogy.
Starts off as a joke, and it turns into a review.
Yes, it's a problem of identity over time.
That would be another piece that Mark mentioned briefly. Thinking about what identity is and calling things the same or saying that this is that, his discussion has a lot to say about questions of identity.
And that's actually a good segue into definite descriptions, because one of the motivations for definite descriptions is statements of identity.
I'm sorry, but can you remind me? He's reacting to definite descriptions.
Yeah, I'm going to try and say what they are here.
They're from Frege and Russell. Is that the deal?
Okay. Russell in particular. Yeah.
Russell in particular.
Yeah. You can just think of a definite description as a noun phrase starting with the word the.
So I was going to say to give you the motivation, one of the motivations first, because then it makes it easier. So there's this planet Venus, and you might not have known that what looks like a star in the morning sky is the same Venus that is the star in the evening sky. So you might think that this thing, the morning star, is different than the evening star. And you could discover, conceivably, that the morning star is the evening star, or Hesperus is Phosphorus. That's another way to put it. And then the question is, for those statements of identity, what makes them informative? Because we know they're informative. There's new information there. I've learned something in this case. And under a kind of simple theory of names, which is associated with John Stuart Mill, if you think that these proper names simply refer to some referent, and then what's going on there is that Hesperus is Phosphorus is just a way of saying A equals A, then there's nothing informative about that. We know A equals A. We know a thing is identical to itself. Frege came up with this distinction between sense and reference that helps us out with that. You can have the same referent under two different senses, which will become, for Russell, under two different descriptions. The innovation for Russell is this idea that even a proper name, in a way, is a kind of description. Matt, do you want to take it from there and give it more precisely with what a definite description is?
So you can think of a definite description as a phrase beginning with the word the host of the Partially Examined Life, or the President of the United States. So Russell was trying to address the question you just mentioned, which is, if you tell somebody Spielberg was the director of E.T., what exactly are you telling them if each noun phrase on either side of that is there, Spielberg and the director of E.T., stand for the same thing? Does that mean they mean the same thing? And if they mean the same thing, how is that different from just saying Spielberg is Spielberg, which is not informative? And what is it that makes the statement Spielberg is the director of E.T. informative? And especially when you have two names, right? Samuel Clemens is Mark Twain. What's going on there? That clearly could tell you something. You might not know that Samuel Clemens is the same person as Mark Twain, and somebody could inform you by telling you that. They wouldn't be saying anything at all interesting if they told you Samuel Clemens is Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain is Mark Twain. Russell's way of addressing this problem, among many others, was to say, you know what? These names of people and names of places, like Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, what these really are is they're just abbreviated definite descriptions, definite noun phrases, like the person who such and such and such. When you say Samuel Clemens is Mark Twain, you're saying something like the author of Huckleberry Finn is
a guy that was born in this state and was called, had Samuel Clemens on his driver's license.
Exactly, something like that.
Or when you're saying Hesperus, you could be saying that this particular star that's in the morning sky right now, something like that.
Right, exactly. The star I saw in the morning is the same star as the star I saw in the evening. If it is the case that those names, Hesperus and Phosphorus, are just shorthand for saying the star I saw in the morning for Hesperus and the star I saw in the evening, I probably got it mixed up, but whatever. If those are just shorthand for the descriptions, that at least explains how you can be saying something informative when you say Hesperus is Phosphorus. Of course, there's a big question here as to, well, which descriptions are associated with the name, and how do we know when we hear the name? Do we just, by telepathy, magically guess the description that the name is an abbreviation of, and so on? So there are a lot of difficulties there. But if somehow we could get around those difficulties, we would at least address this question of what does it mean when you say stuff like Samuel Clemens is Mark Twain or Hesperus is Phosphorus.
And by the way, when we say definite, we just mean the description itself can't be so generic that it picks out more than one referent. So it couldn't be writers.
So an indefinite noun phrase would be one with an indefinite article like a or an, and the definite one would be with paradigmatically with the word the.
Even if you use the, it doesn't seem completely clear that you would, well, your definite description, you know, you're stringing along a whole bunch of different descriptors. There's going to be a question of what is the minimum set? Is there one that ends up definitely describing the thing, or is it, are they all together a cluster of properties?
Exactly. You might have in your mind that Aristotle, you might think of him as the guy that wrote this set of books, or you might think of him as the person who taught Alexander the Great. Well, aren't those both equally good as definite descriptions if they both individually pick him out? But yet, those are different senses. Where Kripke's coming to this is he thinks that this whole point of view doesn't adequately take into account what he calls modal possibilities. In other words, things that might have happened. So, well, what if Aristotle hadn't actually taught Alexander the Great? He wrote all these books, but he hadn't taught Alexander the Great. If we made a statement about Aristotle, would we still be talking about Aristotle? Because if the definite description of it is the guy who taught Alexander the Great, then it seems like in that possible world, in that counterfactual situation where he didn't do that, we would no longer be referring to Aristotle. So that's clearly wrong. So the people who advocate this view, this descriptivist view, said, okay, well, look, there's a lot of properties like that that go into being Aristotle. And you're correctly referring to Aristotle if the majority of those are true. If there's a cluster of properties, and if the majority of them apply, then yeah, you're referring to Aristotle. So maybe actually there's a historical mistake in there, and Aristotle didn't teach Alexander the Great, but he did write these books, but you still know enough about him that you're correctly referring to Aristotle, as opposed to referring to somebody, whoever the actual author of these books was.
The cluster thing can be more complex than that, right? You could say a weighted majority, or that some properties are more important than others, and things like that. So it's this idea of you take the disjunction of all these actual properties of Aristotle that definitely describe him, this or that, or and so on and so forth. The idea is that must somehow correspond to the meaning of the name Aristotle. So we're talking about meaning here.
But don't you still run into this problem? The one that would come to mind as a good example would be Shakespeare. Who's Shakespeare? This guy that wrote all of these plays. If you say that and you mean the guy that you usually see with the half-bald head, that's a picture of him, and then it turns out that actually the guy who wrote those plays was Francis Bacon, not this guy who you have the picture of with the half-bald head, then when you talk about Shakespeare and you mean by Shakespeare the descriptor, that the person who wrote all these plays, what you mean actually, you're referring to Francis Bacon, because that's the guy who actually wrote all those plays, not the guy with the bald head.
Yeah. What do you guys think of that thought experiment, by the way?
You run into this problem where you could be wrong about your descriptors. And so then it ends up when you use those descriptors as the way to refer to Shakespeare or to Aristotle or whatever, is that they end up pointing to something completely different than what actually you intended to. And you would have been wrong in a different way, but it's not what you actually intended to refer to. Right? You didn't intend to refer to the guy who actually wrote the plays in the sense of being wrong about it. You're referring to the guy with the bald head. That's what you meant by Shakespeare.
Kripke's going to say, for sure, you actually meant Shakespeare, that man. I mean, our intuitions, I think, are conflicted on this, because if you're discussing Shakespeare and saying, well, Shakespeare in Hamlet wrote this and this and this and meant this and this and this, obviously you're just referring to whoever it is that wrote Hamlet. You think it's Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And so maybe you're saying it wrong if it was, in fact, not Shakespeare, and somebody could correct you. And, you know, actually, Francis Bacon did that. But still, your sentence would make sense and serve the purpose that it's supposed to serve, this literary analysis.
That's right. And I guess what you're pointing out is the terms in which I was wrong about the reference.
That's a case that's almost like the Jack the Ripper case, though, in which we hit. That's actually a complex exception to this. There are cases in which, for instance, the individual is sort of unknown. We don't know much about Shakespeare except that he wrote those plays, right?
So doesn't it apply to anything in which you were wrong in your description? It's easy to pick historical cases where there's little information, but wouldn't it be true in the most trivial way about anything for which you were wrong about it? Mark's point seems to be that there's still a way that the descriptor is still referring, even if you are wrong about what it's pointing to. The descriptor is still unique in its reference, even if you are wrong about what it's referring to.
Wait, so Mark, were you saying that, let's say it was suddenly discovered that tomorrow, it's suddenly unearthed, historians discover that Shakespeare never wrote Hamlet, Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, any of those plays. That was all misinformation. Some other person, Shakespeare's mom really wrote them. Were you saying that just now when we talk about, look at what Shakespeare does at this passage in Hamlet, when we said that after this discovery, we'd actually be talking about Shakespeare's mom?
Yes.
No, that's epistemological possibility, right? That's distinct mm-hmm. from the possibility that he's talking about. So if we find out, for instance, that it's the case in the actual world that Shakespeare's mom wrote the plays, that's just a case of our lack of knowledge.
So we'd be saying something false, but we'd be saying it about Shakespeare. We wouldn't suddenly now be talking about Shakespeare's mom. That's the prediction that Kripke's sort of thought experiment would have to make. That's the prediction he wants it to make.
And yeah. I think that contrast gets at what the dispute is about here is, so you've just had a whole literary discussion about Shakespeare and what he wrote in Hamlet. And we write down all those sentences. I say on page one, Shakespeare said this. On page two, Shakespeare says this. We find out the next day that actually Shakespeare didn't write any of these. His mom wrote them. Do we now think that this whole page of things that I've written out, that all of these sentences are now false? Because in fact, actually, Shakespeare didn't write any of those things. But really, the point of us having this literary discussion was to discuss what was in the document
they are in a sense false. We know something else about Shakespeare, that he's this guy born at this particular time in Stratford-on-Avon to these particular parents and married this particular woman. Then yeah, that's false, because Shakespeare refers to that guy, and it turns out that guy did not write those plays. So Shakespeare isn't just simply the guy who wrote those plays. We can do a counterfactual on that. We can say, what if Shakespeare hadn't written those plays and still be referring to the guy who was born of those parents at that particular time and so on and so on.
Right. So that's, you're stating Kripke's position.
In the same way that when we say that Nixon won the presidential election in 1968, and then we do a counterfactual in which Humphrey won it, it doesn't mean that we were never referring to Nixon. We were always referring to Humphrey.
Are you talking about the definite descriptor version of this? Or are you talking about Kripke's response to it?
Wes is giving Kripke's response.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I was trying to lay out that what the two responses are. And you seem to find the Russell response so vile and unintuitive that it cannot even be spoken all the way.
What do you mean in the Russell response?
The idea that names are, in fact, definite descriptions.
Oh.
So when we're having this literary discussion, what I meant by Shakespeare is, well, whoever it was that wrote this play, I don't really care that it's the guy with the bald head. That's like a thing that's on the back cover. That's not relevant to the discussion. Relevant to the discussion is the author discovering that that guy Shakespeare with the bald head didn't write stuff. Okay, yeah, it demands an appendix be made at the end of the book. But everything that we said in our literary discussion is, you know, if it was good literary analysis, is still right on. It's sort of beside the point. This is the definite description view that's associated with Russell. Strangely enough, historically, then gets tied back to the pragmatists and really everybody who pays attention to, well, why are we actually bothering to make this point in the first place, and thinks that if we discovered something like this, then maybe it just shouldn't be clear who we were talking about. If we discover, you know, I thought that the bald-headed guy was the guy who wrote these plays when I was having this discussion with you. When we discover it was not, it's not that, oh, now, you know, we were simply wrong in this whole discussion. It's that our intuitions should fall apart, that what we had in mind in this whole discussion ended up not being true. You might say, well, what were you referring to when you meant Shakespeare? Well, I meant the guy who wrote the plays, and I meant this guy who has the bald head. And it turns out, actually, since no individual satisfies both of those descriptions.
You're just relying on this particular case in which we don't know that much about Shakespeare. You know, it's not the case that when we find out that something that we thought was true isn't true about an individual, that all our references to those individual become suddenly bogus, right?
If it's a single thing that we found out, or that we're considering a counterfactual case where this didn't actually happen, then you're correct. But if we are expanding the descriptivist view to include the cluster of descriptions, which is really everything you know about the guy. So imagine if everything you know about Nixon, not just that he was the president at this time and blah, 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 but all the stuff about his appearance, about what he said, that I am not a crook, whatever. And then you found out that actually Nixon was killed at birth and replaced with another baby or a robot or whatever that in fact did all that stuff. Would you then say, oh, I guess Nixon didn't do any of that? Or would it be
that? Yeah, you do in that case, but that's a different case. Kripke's point is that you could have a case in which Nixon didn't do any of the things that we've
done. Yes, according to Kripke.
He didn't go into politics. He didn't do that. So there's nothing about, now you can't go so far as to say he didn't have the same parents, and we'll get into why. Or that he was replaced by demons like the cats. You can't go that far and still say you're referring to the same Nixon, because they're going to turn out to be these essential things which will ruin what he calls this rigid designation, which we'll explain in a second. I think the way to sum up his objection to the cluster thing is that you could deny all of those properties and still be talking about Nixon.
Why are you resistant to that conclusion, Mark? I'm curious about, why wouldn't we just say in that scenario that, well, everything we thought we knew about Nixon was false? That's precisely why my mind is blown. Yeah, this Nixon guy is not at all who I thought he was. But that whole time, I'm still referring to the same guy. It seems like you want to resist that.
I'm trying to represent the descriptivist position in that
if
all of these things turned out to be wrong, then I think our intuitions are not designed to cover that case.
I see.
Kripke's position was, no, actually Nixon was killed at birth, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So everything we thought about this individual is wrong. Or the other option would be, oh, well, I guess the robot or the replacement, the clone, whatever, since that's who we've been calling Nixon this whole time, let's say Nixon actually was that thing. It's just that Nixon, we thought was a person, or, you know, we thought was born of this and this parents, but actually wasn't, or wasn't actually a person or whatever. But the name actually does refer to, well, it's hard to say it's just a description, because this is somebody like we've seen on TV. So if we say Nixon is that guy, it would be hard to, if it turned out that it was a hologram or something, It's hard to say we were wrong about our pointing. When you're not considering somebody like, you know, a historical figure that we have no direct witness of, I think Kripke is exactly right in those cases.
I see. So it sounds like what you're saying then is that maybe our common sense beliefs about really crux historical figures are so tied into our knowledge about everything else that maybe we just want to say that if all that was upended, that would just lead us into skepticism because all of our knowledge is tied into all of our other knowledge in really deep ways. You know, but that's just an extreme case or something like that.
Kripke presents himself as the champion of common sense here. You know, the question you ask, why does Matt refer to you instead of me? Well, because your parents named you Matt and you grew up there and everybody called you Matt and you call yourself Matt, et cetera, et cetera.
That's
there's
the
a
account.
Clear. Yeah. And if you explain that to somebody, they're going to be like, why the hell did you need a philosopher to say that? That's stupidly obvious. We've tried, I guess, to motivate what he was reacting against, which is the idea that, well, if you think that names always just refer to the person, then what about names of things, for instance, that don't actually exist? If we say Santa Claus did this and this and this, it seems like that you can't just point to, oh, that's Santa Claus, you know, in the same way you can point to Matt. So there has to be some other way of analyzing that sentence so that it doesn't come up meaningless or absurd or every sentence about or of indeterminate truth value that he wants to say that Santa Claus, well, is actually a description. Santa Claus is the guy that delivers presents, blah, 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 lives at the North Pole. And so the correct analysis of Santa came to my house last night is there is some being that brings present, you know, gives the whole description. And that being came to my house last night or has a beard or whatever the thing you want to say about Santa Claus. And since you analyze it that way.
The correct is that there does not exist an X such that X did all that.
Exactly. So you can just say, no, that's simply false. It's not meaningless because Santa Claus doesn't refer to anyone or something.
That's one of the other cases in which definite descriptions are meant to help us out. That's another counterexample that he addresses near the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you can't actually point for him. It's the Santa in the story.
Kripke thinks he's championing intuition in the sense that what we're doing when we do these counterfactuals, he uses this metaphor. It's not that we are looking at this other world through a telescope and we're not going to be able to make anything out if we don't have these necessary and sufficient conditions of identity. And it's not even intuitively the mind works that way when we refer to things like, oh, I know this is a computer or something. I know this is the individual because of these criteria. What he's saying is that we actually stipulate identity. We don't need to discover it. We just stipulate it when we're doing the thought experiment. It's part of the description of the possible world that this is identical to this.
I'm glad you mentioned that passage. I think that's a real kind of crux passage here. And it gets at this big debate between him and the philosopher David Lewis about what the nature of a possible world is. And you see here that Kripke is really taking the position that if I say there's a possible world in which I have a sister, so I don't actually have a sister. So if I say there is a possible world in which I have a sister, that's just shorthand for saying I might have had a sister. That's just another manner of speaking, as it were. Whereas some other philosophers, most famously David Lewis, wanted to really take this talk of possible worlds literally and say that there are things that are possible worlds. They're just like our world. The only difference is they're not actual, blah, 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 blah. So Kripke is really trying to sort of push back against that and say that this idea of a possible world, it's basically just a manner of speaking. And these possible worlds that we talk about sometimes when we're doing logic are really just these sort of theoretical projections of the actual world. And that's connected to the identity thing, because if the alternate world, so to speak, in which I had a sister is just an extrapolation from the actual world, it's like, well, we imaginatively just sort of project the actual world and change a little bit of it. Then it's, I think, clearer how Matt in this world can be the same person as Matt in that other world, because Matt in that other world, we just got to that other world by like futzing with this world in our minds.
I think another way to put that is when I do these counterfactuals, when I do these thought experiments and say, what if I'm already stipulating? So why can't I stipulate the identity of the thing that I'm talking about, right? Why do I have to get fancy in figuring out how those two things are going to be identical? The Matt that doesn't have a sister and Matt. So for instance, when I do a thought experiment where I say, what if Nixon hadn't won the United States election in 1968? Why do I have to rediscover Nixon, the individual, the referent, through some other definite description in the possible world? Why can't I just stipulate that I'm talking about Nixon, the same individual in both possible worlds, except with the difference that Nixon didn't win the election in the possible world that I'm talking about. Again, I stipulate, this is the language Kripke used, I stipulate the identity as part of my description of the possible world. I don't have to first stipulate the possible world and then to do all this work to retrieve the individual in it. It's a natural part of the counterfactual to stipulate identity.
And supposedly that works for not just the one property, but you know, the extreme view that I just gave, that if I say, well, suppose that Nixon had been killed at birth.
No, it doesn't work.
And that somebody else did all these other things. So then if you ask in this alternate world, which would be Nixon? Would it have been the one who was killed at birth, or would it have been the one who replaced Nixon and did all these things? Well, the way I set it up, I just said Nixon was killed at birth. So
yeah, right. Exactly.
There is no Nixon in that world.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's a Nixon-like thing. There's something with the phenomenal properties of Nixon.
Right. You could have someone who's exactly like Nixon in that world, but yeah.
Hey, before we go any further, let's talk about our sponsor this time. Wes, tell us about Squarespace.
Building a website is not an easy thing for a beginner. Even if you're a coder, it can be a time-consuming affair. Squarespace is a company that can make it easy to build beautiful websites without all that effort. Squarespace can help you build a simple, powerful, and beautiful website that looks professionally designed, regardless of skill level, and no coding required. Not only does it provide you with intuitive and easy-to-use tools to create the website, it also has state-of-the-art technology powering your site so that it's secure and stable. You know, you can trust Squarespace for your website needs when millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world trust in them too.
So imagine a possible world in which you use Squarespace and it was awesome. Does that mean in all possible worlds, using Squarespace would have made it awesome?
Yes. Squarespace is a rigid designator. No. Unless it's an essential property. Could be like, you know, having the same parents. Which
is neither a necessary nor sufficient condition for having a good website, but it is strongly correlated.
Very strongly correlated. So go get your Squarespace before they sell out of them. You really can't beat the ease and simplicity. It gives you 24/7 online support and a beautiful website for just $8 a month. You can even get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. So what are you waiting for? Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, when, not if, make sure to use the offer code PEL to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the Partially Examined Life.
Squarespace, build it beautiful. Thanks, Wes. We're also supported this time by The Great Courses. If you're listening to this podcast, you like learning stuff and you like passively listening and learning stuff instead of actually taking a class. So The Great Courses are engaging video and audio lectures taught by top professors, perfect for all of us who love to learn. Now, there's a big overlap, I think, between people who listen to this podcast and folks that like other cultural stuff, like classical music. And we recently watched The Great Courses collection on music's great masters, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, and Tchaikovsky. There's a course on each of them. Each lecture series has 8 45-minute episodes, and they're really damn interesting. I listened to a big chunk of the one on Tchaikovsky and got a lot of insight into where the music was coming from, his tortured personal life, how it influenced the intensity and rich melodic beauty in his music. And of course, that's just one of many. They've got many things in philosophy. They've got stuff in religion, history, and more. As one of our listeners, you get a special deal from The Great Courses. If you order one of these 4 Great Masters courses, it's just $9.95, which is crazy. Less than $10 for 6 hours of fascinating content, and you'll feel smarter. You'll be able to impress people that you know cultural things now, whereas philosophy knowledge impresses no one.
Because they do not know what the fuck you're talking about.
But classical music knowledge, everybody at least thinks they understand that. So that's okay.
And they deliver that to you on these little round discs, right?
Oh, yes. They're available as DVDs, digital streaming, or downloads with the Great Courses apps. The special price of $9.95 is only available for a limited time. So order today by going to thegreatcourses.com/PEL. That's thegreatcourses.com/PEL. All right, let's get back to the discussion.
But I think it's really interesting how he brings out these two things are connected, like whether you think of a possible world as a theoretical sort of tool that we use for reasoning, or whether you think of it as literally like another world. That issue is tied into whether the same person can be in different worlds. And if you think that these possible worlds are literally other worlds, then you're kind of pushed to say that there is no such thing as the same person in multiple worlds. Because look, they're totally different worlds. How could it be the same person in different worlds? And then you have to come up with this elaborate theory about, well, okay, somebody who's a lot like me in another world, that's who I'm reasoning about when I think about, what if I had a sister? It's not really me. What if Matt, strictly speaking, had a sister? It's like, what if Matt, somebody really similar to Matt had a sister? And so on and so forth.
Can I ask a question about that way of viewing possible worlds or actual possible worlds? Why isn't it just patently absurd because the multiplicity of possible worlds is outrageous?
Well, it was very controversial, so a lot of people felt that way. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe we'll read some, Lewis. I think we're mostly not going to be able to answer this question, but I think one of the answers that there's something troubling to logic about modality, about could, about might, about must. I think coming up with the notion of possible worlds is supposed to somehow, this is not the way Kripke uses it, but the way at least Lewis uses it is to reduce that. They all become just is statements, declarative statements that happen to be about some other world.
Yeah. The reason to me that you would do that in this modal issue is that you sort of establish that now much larger universe contains all the denominators. And so then you could even talk about how possible is it.
Yeah, count up the worlds.
Yes, yeah.
I'm reminded of this. Have you guys ever seen Rick and Morty? It's like a cartoon on, what's the network?
Adult Swim.
Adult Swim. Have you seen it, Mark?
No.
But they play around with this question of, there are a bunch of universes and every possibility or combination of possibilities are articulated in one of them. And they do a lot of clever stuff with it. I think we should reiterate, that's not really what's going on here.
Can I just ask a question? Because you guys, I've been kind of blown away by your how fast you guys are going on this. In the following sense, is that I guess maybe because I wasn't on the Russell and Frege episode.
Oh, yeah. That was a pre-Dylan era, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I forgot about that.
We've been talking about how Kripke is reacting against the definite description model of naming presented by Russell and Frege. And as Mark said, predominantly Russell, I guess.
Just to clarify, so Frege came up with the idea that we have to distinguish reference from sense, looking at stuff like the morning star and the evening star. So phosphorus and hesperus is the same reference. They have different sense, but he kind of left sense like, well, what is sense, a psychological thing? It wasn't really clear. And so Russell is trying to make that much more specific, that like it is a sentence. It is the star that we see in the body that we see in the sky in the morning. And that's not something that's like in anybody's in particular's head, or it seemed less problematic.
Another important thing here is that in Russell's picture, there is an intimate relating between meaning and reference. Meaning helps us refer. Kripke is going to break that. He's going to say that, no, meaning is not the mechanism by which we refer.
Well, it's a mechanism maybe by which we fix the reference in the first place.
Right. We'll get into reference fixing, but we should talk about rigid designators first, since that's the thesis of this book. That proper names, or as he calls them, just he's going to call them names, are rigid designators in the sense that in every possible world, they designate the same object. So go ahead, Dylan, sorry.
Okay. Just to make it really clear what this definite descriptor model is that is Frege and Russell that Kripke is reacting against, can we say something like what it is in five sentences that Russell and Frege are reacting against, or what the problem that they're solving is? I heard you say, Mark, you know, about the sense and meaning and stuff like that, but...
Well, that was the whole Hesperus-Phosphorus identity thing. That's one of the problems. There's actually a few of them.
There's the problem of things that don't exist. How do you refer to something that doesn't exist?
Okay.
That was one of them.
So I think having these things in mind makes the conversation a lot clearer, right? Why would you even care about trying to worry about this kind of stuff?
Yeah. So if you're doing logic, you want to be able to say that every sentence is either true or false or just malformed. That's not even a sentence at all. And it looked like if you were talking about an imaginary object, if you're talking about unicorns, then it's neither true nor false. If you say unicorns live in Australia.
Instead of just being false, the unicorn fails to refer to anything and we have a meaningless sentence.
Yes.
Yeah. And it seems weird that an obviously meaningful sentence should be meaningless according to this pre-Fregean picture.
And the same thing applies to negative existentials. So even if you wanted to say unicorns do not exist, you have a problem, the same sort of problem. So you're stuck even if you're trying to say something.
Are you going to say, well,
true.
It's really my idea. Well, we don't have unicorns, but we have ideas of unicorns. But you don't want to say, well, it's my idea of a unicorn that doesn't exist. That's not what you're saying.
Yeah.
Whereas if you replace Well, the unicorn is maybe trickier, but if we switch it to Santa Claus, right? He also doesn't exist.
Well, no, just to unicorn. Unicorns, horses with with the horns on the you know, the single horn.
Yeah, it's not obvious how unicorns are harder than Santa Claus, but
because it's a predicate. But
unicorn is a predicate.
It's not a proper name.
That's true.
So yeah, do Santa Claus. Yeah.
So I say there is no Santa Claus, and you might think that's a little bit self-contradictory because I'm like, there is no. This, what is there none of? Oh, this guy. I'm like, but now I'm like pointing at nothing or something. That's maybe a little bit intuitively odd. But then if you take Santa Claus and you're like, all right, let's erase that and replace it with the dude who rides a sleigh and climbs chimneys and gives people presents, then there's no mysterious reference to this non-existent thing that's not in our world. Because from a certain point of view, you can say that all you're saying is, give me anything in the actual world, any actual thing, that's not going to be a chimney climbing sleigh rider that gives people presents. This desk in front of me is not a chimney climbing sleigh rider who gives people presents. Barack Obama.
So in other words, what seems like a name isn't actually a name. It includes predication within it. So the way Russell parses this out is that not the case that there exists an X such that X is this unique individual thing and X is Santa Claus, right? Or fits these properties.
Yeah. And so the big goal here is a question of logic, of language, and being able to talk precisely.
Yep.
Okay.
What are the things that you're, you know, that you state? What are they about? And that question gets weird when you're talking about something that doesn't exist from a certain point of view.
And that's way back in Plato, right? I mean, he asks that same question.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Or about talking about circumstances in which we don't know of some identity. So that Cicero and Tully were the same, for instance.
Or that Hesperus and Phosphorus are the same, right? That's actually a discovery.
Yeah. How can we do justice to the fact that that's a discovery?
There's the other case of, you know, I believe that Hesperus, the typical example is that Cicero, but not Tully, was a Roman when Cicero is Tully. So I could believe, you know, in this case of indirect reference, I can believe things based on my lack of knowledge that they're actually identical. And this whole definite descriptions thing comes in handy here too, because I'm just believing that two different descriptions don't refer to the same object. I'm not believing that X doesn't actually equal X, which is absurd, which I couldn't rationally believe.
I do want to request that we try to choose examples throughout the rest of this podcast that will be meaningful to our audience instead of some of the ones that are in the book, like Cicero and Tully, which I've never heard about Tully other than in this context.
Well, Tully is what the English, to give a definite description, what the English call Cicero. Is that a definite
description? Has anybody heard of Hesperus and Phosphorus before Frege? Like, I'm pretty sure he invented those those names.
Yeah, he thought the evening star and the morning star already looked too descriptive, right? So we want to get them to be as proper name-ish as possible.
I mean, the thing I heard of is Venus. That's the one that I always heard of. But apparently has these other names too.
Well, there's a time when people didn't know that they were the same. But is there really a time? Actually, that's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know. According to Frege, the Babylonians discovered it or something. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So we know what motivates definite descriptions now. And then I think Dylan, are we clear on what motivates Kripke's kind of rebellion against that?
Just having been listening the whole time, I think this would be a good point to sum up that as well. So we just summed up what Russell and Frege were trying to do, being able to articulate what it is we mean when we say things.
So the summary of why Kripke doesn't like it is because this theory of reference seems to break down when we start talking about possibility and counterfactuals. And because I could say that what if Aristotle hadn't been the greatest philosopher who's Plato's student or something like that. So, and I need to be able to make sense of that counterfactual. And if I think the definite description is somehow by definition is the meaning of Aristotle, it doesn't seem how I can talk about those possibilities in which Aristotle didn't do those things. And then the cluster theory tries to remedy that by saying, okay, we're not going to just talk about one definite description. We'll just chunk together all these different ones that say either this or this or this or this. And then the meaning is some concatenation of those properties. You know, we can do a lot of different things there, or at least one of them, or however you want to say it. And that seems to break down because then we could say nothing we think we know about Aristotle is true and yet still be referring to Aristotle despite the evaporation of all those definite descriptions.
Is one way of characterizing Kripke's agenda is that the definite descriptor, even the cluster description model, is essentially too rigid and it doesn't allow for dealing with counterfactuals and
it's not rigid enough, actually.
Yeah, it's the other way around. So
it's what?
It's not rigid enough.
It's not rigid enough. So definite descriptions.
We're a little bit half joking on that. But
yeah, exactly. Definite descriptions change depending on what world you're in, as it were, what world you're looking at. Whereas the idea is a name keeps referring to the same thing, no matter which imaginary different possible world you're looking at. Whereas a definite description is going to change with each world, because in different worlds, different things are going to satisfy the description. And so thinking that names are just the same thing as descriptions is going to get the meaning of names when you're doing this what-if type stuff wrong.
We have to give one of the qualifications, though, that he gives about this. By saying the name doesn't change across possible worlds, that's not saying that in all possible worlds, people would call this person Aristotle. It's the fact that I, right now, as I am referring to these people in these other possible worlds, my name, Aristotle, as I use it as an English speaker in this type, blah, 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 is always going to refer to that person, regardless of what he ended up doing. Or
he might have been given a different name in that world.
Yeah. And you would then say in that world, Aristotle was given a different name. You wouldn't say there was no Aristotle, there was somebody else.
Yeah. And it's really confusing at first, because when he says a rigid designator refers to the same thing in all possible worlds, that just sounds like it's necessarily true that my name is Matt, which is obviously false. My parents could have named me whatever, you know, and then he clears this up a couple places in the lectures. I mean, one way I like to think of it is to say that Matt is a rigid designator is to say that whichever other alternate circumstance we're considering, we're still considering that about Matt, the same guy we're talking about when we consider what's actually the case. Matt is constant.
We're still talking about the guy who is Matt in this world.
We're still talking about the guy who is Matt in our world, even if we're thinking about different other things that could have happened. It's always things that could have happened with that same guy, Matt.
So the problem that Kripke is reacting against is that Russell and Frege, the definite descriptors, is not fixed enough, so it doesn't allow you to actually pin down and have clarity about what you're speaking of. It's not actually solving the problem that Russell and Frege were trying to solve. They were trying to solve the problem of being able to be precise about what you say. And Kripke's saying, in fact, they've made it so you're utterly imprecise about what you say because you allow all of these counterfactual situations and you don't actually refer to anything. So you don't...
Well, you're not imprecise in the actual world. It gets shaky when you, start talking about these counterfactuals.
So you could imagine Frege responding and saying, like, well, we shouldn't talk modally. We shouldn't talk about counterfactuals at all.
Yeah, and that's the Quine line, you know.
But it seems to me that the reason why you want to talk about things that way is because you want to figure things out, is that you're acknowledging that you go through the world, and it's not that the world presents it to you as, this is why I was thinking Kripke was reacting to them because it was too rigid, because it seemed that everything that you would say would be a kind of mathematical statement, that one thing would lead to another in a very direct way. And the reason you would be concerned about modality is that you acknowledge that in the world you spend a lot of your time figuring things out and you're making judgments.
It seems like they have to be meaningful.
I'm asking the question that I'm understanding this correctly, that Kripke is making an account for how we can be speaking and figuring things out and therefore allowing for this modal talk.
Yeah, because we obviously do this. We engage in this kind of talk and it's actually very important, you know, if you're planning and figuring out one possibility or another, or you're thinking about what you could have done differently, then the question is, are those statements meaningless? I don't know, what is, or are they somehow what would Quine say about modal statements? Does he think they're meaningless? Or?
I think pretty obviously that they're epistemic. Kripke is insisting that at least as far as our language is concerned, you know, ultimately he's kind of following in the steps of Wittgenstein in being a natural language philosopher. So he's trying to say, what is the way we talk about things? We talk about things as if they could have happened some other way. I could have gone to the store yesterday, or I could have stayed home. You know, is that an ultimate metaphysical fact, or is that a fact about language? I guess he's maybe not so interested in making that distinction. But in any case, there seems no reason to think, given the way we talk about things, that would not have been possible. You know, even if you argued for some strong metaphysical determinism that actually, in fact, everything is caused. And so, yeah, there's physical necessity. So it could not have been the case that if I didn't, in fact, go to the store today, that I could have gone to the store yesterday, because anything that didn't happen couldn't have actually happened. I don't think that he would be worried by that.
We could have a possible world in which the laws of physics and everything else are different, or different initial conditions, things like that. So physical possibility depends upon the actual scientific laws in this possible world, but it still allows for metaphysical deviations. It doesn't imply logical necessity.
You know, modal skepticism, I think that's accurately attributed to Quine. That's a very radical position. And there's a real question, since we're constantly in conversation with each other talking about what if blah, blah, blah had happened instead of what actually did happen. There's a lot to explain away if you want to really dig in your heels and be a modal skeptic.
But it's still unclear to me that it actually helps you find things out. I think I see why you're saying that, Dylan, because of course, when you're making experimental predictions, then you're like, well, it could turn out this way and it could turn out this way. But that's not the same as saying there is some possible world in which it does turn out this way and there is a possible world in which it doesn't. Like, that's actually something that Kripke specifically argues against. That kind of possibility that actually helps us discover things, I think, really is just a matter of epistemic, a matter of our knowledge, a matter of saying, well, as far as we know, it could be this way or that way.
I don't see how that can be true, because then you're denying that it could be possible. It can't just be that it only seems possible. It has to also be possible. I don't know. Matt, can you explain that better?
I mean, can we make this more concrete in terms of a scientific experiment? And this is not the kind of thing he talks about. We're trying to figure out what the ultimate implications here are. For instance, what he does talk about is we're doing an experiment to find out if the atomic number of gold is going to be whatever.
Well, this is a more complicated.
Okay. Well, what's a simpler example?
How about like all bodies fall at the same speed?
Is that a scientific experiment? I was trying to get what Dylan was getting at, and maybe you can explain, Dylan, and why you think modality is supposed to help us find things out. Dylan, do you have a response to that?
Well, I guess I just had in mind things at the end of the book that when you're trying to figure things out, and sussing things out in experiment is a perfectly good way to talk about it, but you could talk about trying to figure out anything. It involves a lot of coulds, and if you want to get a little bit highfalutin and using the examples that he uses, you would want to say, well, heat could be the motion of molecules, or heat could be a substance that permeates all materials that adds and subtracts heat. You know, this is the phlogiston model, right? And that it's measured in a certain amount of caloric that everything has, and if it has enough caloric, then it has more heat.
He's going to say the opposite, though, that it's not the case that heat could have been that.
No, I know.
This is why I think the scientific examples actually lead us in the wrong direction.
But I mean, I think scientific laws are inescapably modal because they contain an implicit must. So, which is the dual, you might say, of could.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But couldn't science also discover some contingent truths? I mean, any observation is scientific. If we're trying to discover, did Nixon actually win the election? Well, you go and do research. You look it up in the same way a scientist of a certain sort would. So in that case, you as the scientist, as the researcher, are discovering something that is a contingent truth. Whereas if you're discovering a natural law, I think, according to Kripke, then you're discovering a necessary truth. So that both of these are involved with science.
If you discover that heat is the motion of molecules, or however he puts it, you're discovering something necessary. If you're discovering that Nixon was elected in 1968, you're discovering something that is contingent. And my point about the problem with modal skepticism is you can't say, when I say it's possible that Nixon might have lost the election in 1968, I'm not saying something about what's in my head or something about my knowledge. I'm saying something about the world. And so I'm sure Quine has some very fancy, inventive ways of getting around that. I'm just saying it's not trivial to jump into this modal skeptic thing. So,
yeah, and that's a big debate, I think, in the philosophy of science. Are scientific laws describing the way things actually must be in the actual universe from a person-independent point of view, or are they just describing what we're most confident about? Probably most people gravitate towards the former option, but there are definitely people who defend a more subjectivist option, especially if you're looking at the philosophy of probability. So in philosophy of probability, it's all just about our confidence option is a lot more popular.
Interesting.
Well, it seems I don't want to leave the paradigm case of a contingent scientific discovery as Nixon won the election or something. But it seems even every individual experiment that you run, right, as we know, you don't directly prove a scientific law through an experiment.
No.
Like every individual outcome is something that it could have gone either way. Because even if the underlying principle that you're trying to support or refute to falsify whatever is a necessary truth, you know, whatever it ends up being, it's going to be necessary, according to this.
So, yeah, that is the epistemic case.
But it could be that something went wrong in the experiment, or, you know, there could be a lot of things that affect the outcome of some particular experiment. And so that'll always be a matter of could have been either way.
Yeah, so I think another way to say that is the observation and experiment part of science, where you go out and you gather data, the data gathering part, that's not modal. That's not looking at other possible worlds. That's looking at the actual world. Then when you extrapolate from that inductively and try to figure out what law are these observations, you know, what's really underlying that, that's the modal part. That's the part that goes into other possible worlds.
Another way to put this is we might have discovered that gold had an atomic number of 80. So that actually is the case, but that's epistemic in the sense that initially that's just a matter of our knowledge. So once we discover that it's 79, then it is necessarily 79 across all possible worlds. It's not like the fact of the matter is not necessary. It's just the possibility part is actually has to do with our lack of knowledge. So,
and again, it doesn't matter if people in these other worlds didn't use a base 10 numbering system or something like that, or had totally different ways of describing it, because it's us here describing those possible worlds, just to clarify.
Should we talk about his examples to motivate the difference between what we know and what actually is the case in the world? You know, so the standard meter example, or maybe the computer proving a math theorem example.
Yes, let's get to this whole fixing thing.
Yeah.
You should read some quotes.
Yeah. Some quotes, yeah.
We get to fixing on page 53.
It's interesting. I mean, this is a really big break from stuff that came before, because it was assumed that, you know, anything you know a priori, that is to say without observing the world, is something that's necessarily true. And anything that's contingent, that seems accidental, that could have been otherwise, is something you have to learn by observing the world, i.e. a posteriori. So Kripke was really kind of pulling these two notions apart and arguing that they're totally independent. That would have been pretty big at the time.
So fixing is a case of a priori, but contingent, interestingly enough.
Yes.
Say more about that.
Yeah. So there's the standard meter in Paris, which is we figured out what length exactly was a meter by just sort of pointing at this concrete object and saying, let that be a meter.
It's steel.
Right. Yes. Oh, did I? Yeah.
Concrete would have freeze-thaw variations in length.
Oh, yeah. I think he meant concrete in the philosophical.
Yeah, right.
I'm being an ass. Oh. I'm sorry.
I see. Yes. No, concrete as in, right, as in physically realized. Yeah. So, right. So we pointed at this thing and we stipulated, all right, let a meter be whatever length this thing is. So it's true by definition that a meter is this length of this physical thing. So it's something you can know without observation, because that's just the definition of what a meter is. It's this length, just by stipulation. We didn't have to go do an experiment to figure out that that was how long a meter was. So it's something that you can know a priori. But it's contingent, because we could have chosen a different thing to stipulate that that length was going to be the meter. We could have chosen, I don't know, a Big Mac and decided whatever the width of this Big Mac will be a meter henceforth. So it's a priori, but it's not necessary. And so it's something you know a priori, but it's not necessarily true.
So Wittgenstein thought, for instance, that you couldn't predicate of that bar in France that it was a meter long.
Yeah. Oh,
because it was the standard of being a meter. And I think he thought that the fact of its being the standard somehow is a necessary truth. I don't know if it's for Wittgenstein or some imaginary opponent of Kripke. But of course, that's really not the case, right? Because the bar could be heated in another world and expand. And that doesn't mean that suddenly, oh, the meter changes. Yeah. Meter gets rigidly designated. You fix it in this world. And even if that fixing thing varies in another possible world, that doesn't mean the concept that you've fixed changes. So the bar can expand if you apply heat to it in another world, but that doesn't mean that the meaning of 1 meter has changed.
So the meaning of it is, even though we're saying that we're pointing it out by a concrete object, it is an abstraction. It is that length.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not synonymous. So it isn't a meaning in the traditional sense. The whole point of using this word fixing is to say that the length of that bar in Paris there is not synonymous with 1 meter. It's fixed by it in this world at this particular time. And then once it gets fixed, it's rigidly designated and the standard can change, but the meaning doesn't.
Let's just consider this alternate case. So Matt is born, his parents name him Matt, and we say that is this baptism is the fixing of, you know, now that they've named Matt, that is Matt in all possible worlds, even ones where he was not named Matt, you know, as long as he exists in that world, maybe he wasn't born at all, but that will be Matt no matter how different he is. But he wants to say still that's not part of the definition of Matt. The definition of Matt, the meaning of Matt is not, according to this, if we carry the analogy forward, just like the meaning of meter is not this stick, the meaning of Matt is not the person who was born to these parents and called this.
Right. That's the reference. Yeah.
But the thing that you referred to a couple of times is that being born to particular parents at a particular time, you know, of a particular sperm and egg, does seem to be both necessary and sufficient for being Matt.
Yeah. So now we're jumping ahead to essential properties.
Yeah.
Are we ready to do that? Or?
Yeah. It sounds like this is going to turn into a potential objection then, right? Because if those conditions are enough to fix the reference of Matt, maybe that's the definite description associated with Matt, right? It seems like that's where you're going, Mark.
So it seemed like we could vary any property we wanted at first, right? And still have a rigid designator anchor all that. But it turns out there are going to be things which break our stipulation of identity. And one of these things is essential properties, which includes, by the way, origins of things and the kind of stuff it's made of. So we can't really have a counterfactual in which we say, what if Matt had been born to different parents? Because in that case, the stipulation of identity is in direct contradiction to something which obviously breaks identity.
But I stipulated, I just said, it's Matt who was born to those other parents. Can't I just stipulate it?
No.
His game, his rules. One thing about these examples, I think, is that he's not trying to argue that a person necessarily has the parents they have. He's just sort of like taking that for granted, just so he has an easy example of a necessary feature. He's taking it for granted that you, the audience, will think, oh yeah, that's a necessary feature of a person, but he doesn't give any argument for that. Likewise with water being H2O, these are supposed to be sort of ready-to-hand examples that he can use to illustrate the points about necessity. But then, of course, we can have a big debate about, well, maybe I could have had different parents, or maybe not.
Or, you know, how many of your chromosomes could have changed and you still be Matt?
Yeah, ship of Theseus with people, exactly.
What if Matt was a girl?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. But also, I mean, I think the H2O example ends up being pretty interesting, right? You say that water is H2O. That's not necessarily going to give you all the features that you mean by water.
No. But it will, according to him, be true in all possible worlds. It couldn't have been false that water was H2O. But there's certainly more stuff we can learn about water.
So the difference, I think, you're pointing out between essential properties here and an actual full-blown essence of something.
That, yes.
You know, in the old, if you're Aristotle and you're talking about essences, well, this is supposed to explain. If you talk about water and you don't explain why it's wet.
Exactly. That's exactly
you
right.
haven't given the essence. You need some teleology in there. Yep. And so these are supposed to be things that are
essential properties.
They would be part of the essence if there is an essence, but he's not actually committing himself to saying that everything has a full-blown essence.
Yeah, the problem there is the conjunctive, saying that water is H2O. It's an equality and an identity that seems to fail if you think about it a little bit. But if you say that an essential property of water is that it is made up of H2O.
It's the same thing as H2O. Here's some water, here's some H2O, they're the same. I think that's the thing that's necessarily true.
Well, how does that jive with what Mark just said is the distinction between essential properties and essence?
An essence would have to be a definition, right? Essence would have to give you necessary and sufficient, well, I don't want to say necessary and sufficient conditions for being the thing, because if they're identical, then yes, being H2O is necessary and sufficient for being water. So that's not what a definition is.
The way you just described it, it sounded like that I could easily have an essence that would require a number of essential properties. And I could be talking about something having the number of essential properties that are required of something or object or entity, and that even if I enumerated them, I might not have a complete necessary and sufficient description of the essence of the thing, because I wouldn't have enumerated all the essential properties.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. What's the difference between essence in Aristotle and essence in Kripke? So Mark and perhaps several others suggested that Aristotle's essences are definitions. I think I like that. It's sort of like a definition tells you kind of everything you really need to know about the thing in question, about what it is to be that thing. It's kind of like the last word, whereas an essential property on Kripke's, right?
They're not semantic definitions. They're real definitions. We should say that. They're not dictionary definitions. They are the, you know, this thing? And yeah.
Yeah, they're right. It's more like scientific laws. It's like the deep facts about the thing in the world or something like that.
And it does seem that that's what science is supposed to explore. It's just that discovering that it's H2O is sort of only the first step.
Right.
And you'd have to like, well, why does water flow and feel liquidy to us? Well, because of the interactions of molecules, and you can say differences between liquids and solids and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So pointing out an essential property of something on Kripke's picture, I think, is a lot more modest then. It's more like, hey, here's a thing that has to be true of the thing because of the kind of thing it is. It's not the last word on that thing. And there are other such facts about it that we could uncover. But nonetheless, this is something that could not fail to be the case of this thing because of its nature. That's an essential property.
We can leave this aside, but just admitting that there would be multiple essential properties seems to make statements of equivalence like water is H2O not make any sense. That's a blithe shorthand for something that is not, strictly speaking, the case. Unless you want to make a stronger argument that they are identical. But what we were just talking about is all the reasons why you would not say that they were identical, that they were essential, and that is a different characteristic. And so it's a kind of accident of our language that we use that shorthand, a imprecision of the way we speak when we say that water is H2O or light is electromagnetic radiation or stuff like that.
What's an accident of language?
When we say water is H2O, based upon what we were discussing just a second ago about the notion of essential properties, and we said, well, H2O is an essential property of water, but it is not the essence of water. And that implies that entities can have multiple characteristics that are essential properties, and that when I identify one of them and I say that the entity is that essential property, that that is a imprecise shorthand. That's all I meant by it.
But Kripke is really asserting that identity, right?
Yeah, I think the identity, though, is not between the terms water and the term.
Being H2O is an essential property, okay? But H2O is water. So H2O is identical to water. Being H2O is an essential property of water.
But that means that H2O is water, but water is not H2O, or is not simply H2O or whatever.
Well, H2O is also water. H2O also has the property of being water.
Okay, so I'm completely confused about it now because
they're identical. I think this properties thing might be confusing us.
What I think might clear this up is that it's not the terms H2O and water that are identical. It is the thing that they refer to, remember, which we could get at right. A lot of different things. So maybe one of the ways that I could refer to it is just what was in my glass this morning. That is a way of referring to it happened to be water. Now, that's a contingent way. It's just that if it was that proper name, if it rigidly referred to it, which what I happen to have in my glass this morning is not, but if it rigidly refers to it, so water rigidly refers to that stuff, H2O rigidly refers to that stuff. If they are equal, then they are necessarily equal. Then it's a scientific law that they are equal. So it's not the terms that are equal. It's the thing that is equal to itself.
Right. And we should say here that there's only a subset of these general terms which turn out to be rigid in this way. For the most part, it's only proper names that are rigid. And then it's natural kinds and these mass terms like water and gold and things like that that turn out to be rigid in the same way that proper names are rigid.
And it's also worth mentioning, I think, too, that there are essential properties that you can have besides being identical to yourself. So other example that he gives a lot is a table is composed of molecules. So being composed of molecules, that's just a property. That's not an identity statement. Yeah, the table has the property of being composed of molecules. And that's something that it necessarily has.
But why isn't that an essential property in the same
way?
Okay.
Yeah, but it's not an identity statement. It's not saying this thing is equal to that thing. It's predicating a property of...
So were we wrong by in saying that being equal to water is an essential property of H2O? I mean, I don't think Kripke makes that distinction.
No, he doesn't make the distinction until we get to the mind-brain identity thing.
No, I was just saying the other way around. So there are essential properties of something that can hold up something besides it being identical to itself.
Right.
That assumes being identical is a property. Okay, I guess
we don't need
is.
To talk about properties for this. We just need to talk about the identity of water in H2O.
Well, but he does actually, now that I'm thinking of it, he does stress that, hey, some people deny that there are reflexive properties, that being identical to yourself actually is a property. And he says, it obviously is.
Yeah.
That's the most basic property there is.
That's the whole mind-brain thing where, you can do some work with that.
Yeah.
But in this whole natural, the way he initially introduces it, he doesn't try to confuse us that way, in the way we've tried to confuse ourselves.
If you look at the table example, that's another straightforward case where something can have multiple essential properties. It can be an essential property of the table that it's made of molecules. It can also be an essential property of the table that it like occupies space or something. It wouldn't be what it was anymore if suddenly it ceased to occupy space. That's impossible.
All right, folks, that's all you get for now. Be sure to tune in next time for part two, where we're going to get to issues like personal identity a little, whether that has anything to do with trans world identity as we've been talking about it here, and the aforementioned fruits of the whole project, the scientific identities, and ultimately the mind-body problem. And hey, you don't have to wait. Go sign up to be a Partially Examined Life citizen for a mere $5, and you can get the unbroken, ad-free citizen version of this episode right now, and show your support for our suffering through these texts and sharing them with you. Thanks as always for listening, and good night.